Hey everyone, and welcome back to the Thoughtful Counselor Podcast. Today I'm here with Dr. Susan Stutzner, Director of Disability Services at Southwest Oregon Community College and part-time lecturer at University of Texas, Rio Grande Valley, as well as Angela McDonald, a licensed professional counselor, certified rehabilitation counselor, and a clinician at Frontier Behavioral Health Adult Outpatient Program. Thank you both so much for being here with me on the podcast.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you for having us, Mike.
And you both have endured, or I guess, you know, waited as we've tried to schedule this because I was having a baby, and alas, our baby is born, and so we're getting back to it. So thank you both for being patient in the process of getting this scheduled and recorded. I thought we'd start by just learning about what drew each of you into the counseling profession, and then what brought you to a particular focus around this topic of disability.
Okay, Mike, I'll go ahead and start. So from a young age, I was curious about people and the reasons they do the things they do. In my early formative years, I can be described as a child who always asked the question, why, a lot. While I did not make the connection at that time in how it would play out in my life, I think it reminds me that I've always had a desire to understand myself, others, and the world around me. My first vocation out of college was elementary education. I grew up on the swim team and taught children and adults how to swim, so I felt really comfortable with my abilities to teach people a given concept. This set of experiences led me to the decision of becoming a teacher. After a few years of that, I realized I wanted to work with adults, so I left education and began my own career exploration process of what that might mean. In the early 1990s, I did some soul searching about what I thought I really wanted to do. Thus, I was on a quest to find something I was passionate about and that I felt would make a difference. By this time, I had experienced some of my own life-changing events, which included breaking my back and being paralyzed from the waist down approximately 10 years prior. Throughout the process of physical therapy, I regained some muscle movement and functional mobility, which has stayed with me over the years, but many other parts of my life forever changed. I found myself on a new path in life. The course I knew prior to my injury was not really an option anymore. Some things about my life were very different because of the visibility of my condition. Different considerations and choices had to be made. It wasn't until I found myself considering a profession change that I decided to look at my life and my career goals collectively. During this time, I gave a lot of thought to my personal experiences, my professional skills, my vocational interests, and the interconnectedness of them. From this process, I discovered with a sense of further refinement that I wanted to be a counselor, and that I had a strong desire to work with people with disabilities and their families, and to help them cope and adapt to their situation and to move past it in a positive fashion. Making that decision was the beginning of several wonderful things to come. As I studied to be a counselor, I came across information about the experiences of people with disabilities from a research standpoint, and I was fascinated by what I read and later learned. I wanted to know more. A particular interest was the fact that much of the content I was exposed to wasn't readily available to the public, but it was so very important and relevant to people's situations. Learning about the experiences of people with disabilities, their personal issues, and the societal barriers and attitudes they faced brought life and a face to many of my own experiences. I remember asking myself, how come no one talks about this stuff? This is really important to know and to understand. Over time, I came to understand that more needed to be done than what was currently taking place for people with disabilities and their families. I knew I wanted to be a part of that change and to work with people to understand themselves and the changes they were experiencing. to heal and to be all that they could be. I wanted to help people heal, find their strength, and find their voice.
Yeah, that's beautiful. Thank you so much for sharing that. And Angela, what brought you into the counseling profession and focusing in on disability?
Okay, so again, this is Angela. And so what I think drew me towards the counseling profession and the focus around disability particularly is that from a very early age, I found that I was kind of had my own like little innate inability to not be an advocate. And so that was either for the good or the bad. I would stand up for the underdog and defend anybody that seemed to be perceived as less than the status quo or to potentially be different. And mostly I just wanted equality for everyday thought processes of people's thinking. And so that's what really drew me in, because when I was young, I was stigmatized as wanting to be the center of attention because my voice was always louder than the normal person or the normal child. And so teachers would send me in for hearing examinations every chance that they could. And so my parents were really worried because I have a cousin who's deaf. And so they felt that there must have been something else that was going on with me. And so I remember growing up and I was really embarrassed and I would do things like as simple as a whisper, but everybody would still hear because I couldn't tell it was a whisper or not. And so I couldn't even play like secret games and things like that when I was a kid because everybody could hear what I was saying. And so I felt left out, different and alone. And so I just wanted to be able to talk at the same tone of volume as the other kids and not draw attention to myself. And so, which is kind of funny because my Myers-Briggs, I'm always like in between that E and F or E and I, the external yeah. and the internal. Can you guys hear me?
Yeah, you're great.
Oh, okay. And so I'm always in between those two on the Myers-Briggs type indicator on the internal or the introvert and extrovert type. And so the I normally stands for introversion. And so for the vast majority of time, I was always an introverted person. And so it's kind of interesting that I would have this loud voice and people would have a tendency to gravitate towards hearing everything I was saying, which then made me feel like I was like this fish in a fishbowl where everybody was staring at me. And so also on top of that, I fell riding my bike and I've had a couple traumatic brain injuries. Once the first time was when I was riding my bike as a child. And then kind of a funny story was when a pine cone fell out of a pine tree and smacked me dead center in the head, kind of knocked me out for a little while. And so, you know, over time, those traumas did affect a lot of my abilities to be in school, and not draw attention to myself that way as well. And so those experiences, as well as also a pretty large car accident that I got into that left me with a lot of nerve damage in my neck that's, you know, over the years has exceedingly caused issues, kind of led me into the area of wanting to work with people specifically with traumatic brain injury, as well as even people that have had post-traumatic stress. And so that kind of drew me in along with, you know, just working with people and helping them find accommodations. And so that was basically where I kind of wanted to start working. And so resiliency specifically was where I started at.
Yeah, I'm amazed, I guess not amazed, but the sheer unlikelihood, if that's a word, of an acorn falling directly on your head is so...
Yeah,
I'm not sure how to phrase that, but it's utterly surprising. But I know that it's kind of clearly has a literal and figurative impact with ripple effects.
Right, it was a little Chicken Little moment.
Yeah, something that stood out in both of your narratives there was, you know, I think some people get into different parts of the counseling or helping professions because of just a general interest. And then others find their way into it because of personal experience, their own personal experience or experience with a family member where they want to make a difference with people or themselves that they've had difficulty. And I hear that with both of you having experienced some form of disability through your lifespan, that was a catalyst for both of you at some point jumping into the counseling profession and then specifically working on disability and for you, Angela, resilience, as you mentioned. So something I thought we ought to do before we get too far along is to define or explain what we mean when we say disability. Because I think there's a lot of misconceptions about what disability is and isn't. And I think it would be helpful to build this out before we get too far along. So could you kind of build this out a little bit of when you say disability and do research on disability, what it is that you're actually talking about?
Sure. So disability is a term that's often misunderstood by the general population. It's a word that evokes a lot of inaccurate thoughts and negative emotions by society and by people who don't have a disability. So when we talk about this term, sometimes the mere mention causes some people discomfort. For instance, when people hear the word disability, their mind may focus on negative images or attributes historically associated with having a disability. In severe instances, people who hold strong negative associations toward the word disability or people with disabilities actually physically distance themselves from someone. So then what you'll see is like a visible physical posture where someone, you know, can't really figure out what's taking place. So they physically distance themselves or, you know, engage in some sort of behavior that they may not be aware of. Hmm. But people with disabilities, like Angela talked about, her innate sense, you know, people with disabilities often pick up on those social cues. And so they see the discomfort. So then interacting and understanding the experience isn't always just about knowing what is it that we mean by disability. It may also be some sort of discomfort or awkward situation where someone who doesn't have a disability is trying to figure out what's taking place. So that kind of adds another layer. And so these type of experiences may not only show discomfort, but also display some sort of tendency or message that someone doesn't want to be associated with the person with the disability. Disability is also a word that causes some people to think about the visibility of a person's condition and what the person can't do. So in other words, disability is a term that makes some people think about the way someone's different or perceived as different rather than what's really taking place or what a person can do. So a lot of what Angela and I see in our jobs and, you know, throughout our training is that someone will come to us who has a physical or visible condition, and then we also work with people who have more invisible disabilities and is not readily noticeable. Regardless, though, the way it's defined globally is similar, and many of the experiences that people have are similar. But to the onlooker or the person without a disability, if they don't readily see someone as having a difference, it may be hard for them to understand that if they're not used to being around people with disabilities. So that kind of brings me to my point about perception. And so understanding a person's perception of disability and what it means to have a disability is important, because there's a lot that's been researched and written about the power of inaccurate labels and perceptions held towards people with disabilities. And oftentimes the difficulty is not the disability or condition itself that someone is trying to deal with, but it's the biases, stigma, and negativity associated with having a disability and in dealing with other people's negative attitudes, beliefs, and perceptions. And it's that issue that makes the coping with the disability process difficult or challenging for many people. So when we talk about the word disability, there's also some variations in how it's formally defined, which can make the whole process confusing. And what I often explain to people is when we discuss the word disability, it might be defined a little bit differently if someone is seeking services at a particular agency, or if they're applying for Social Security, or how it's defined under the ADA. And so this can be confusing. So what I'm trying decided to try to do for you today was kind of give you a general understanding of how disability is defined under the Americans with Disabilities Act. So according to the ADA, a person with a disability is someone who has a physical or mental impairment that substantially limits one or more life activity. This includes people who have a record of such an impairment, even if they do not currently have a disability. So what that means, it's actually a three-pronged definition. It means that a person currently has a disability, and it affects one or more parts of their life. Secondly, they may be considered a person who has a record, like has had a disability in the past, even if they don't currently have one. So a more specific example of that would say someone maybe used to have cancer, but now it's in remission. Under the ADA, there may be times in which if they're still regarded as having that impairment, even though they're in remission, they may qualify. So some common disabilities to kind of give you an idea of the broadness and depth of who it covers can include someone with a vision impairment, although it doesn't necessarily mean that they're legally blind. It covers mental health conditions such as bipolar disorder, post-traumatic stress disorder, generalized anxiety. It covers intellectual disabilities, learning disabilities such as ADHD, dysgraphia, dyslexia, acquired brain injuries like Angela talked about. It also covers physical disabilities, so maybe spinal cord injuries, chronic pain, some sort of back injury, neurological and degenerative disabilities such as stroke or multiple sclerosis. It also covers heart conditions or health conditions such as diabetes, irritable bowel syndrome, cancer, just to kind of give you an idea. So, but actually, the complete list of disabilities is a lot more expansive than this. But a disability is any physical, mental, learning, emotional, neurological, or health-related condition that causes substantial limitation and barrier to one's everyday life. So when we refer to limitations in some parts of a person's life, we're looking at ways that the condition affects a person's mobility, communication, learning, processing of information, self-care, self-direction, interpersonal skills, work tolerance, work skills, ability to be independent, and so forth. So as you can see, there's a lot of different ways that a person's life can be impacted, and each person is dealing with something different. So then another important point is the variability of functioning and coping abilities. Two people can have the same diagnosis or condition and have very different outcomes. And I think that's something that people don't always realize. And so when they're trying to understand what does a certain type of disability look like or what does it mean as far as how they're functioning, I think people sometimes are looking for a consistent answer. But what we know, both formally and through our clinical practice, is that no two people cope the same, nor do they have the same set of coping abilities or the same functional limitations. This is something that varies from person to person, and so it can make it somewhat confusing for someone who doesn't have a disability or have a lot of experience in understanding the experience of disability. And so in some, we can't say that all people with a certain condition have the same symptoms or limitations in the same ways.
Yeah, thank you. That's extremely comprehensive. Angela, is there anything you'd like to add to that?
No, I think Susan pretty much covered it. That's what we pretty much see, you know, and the only thing is that, you know, we try to take a person-centered approach when we think of disability as well, because like Susan said, it varies across person to person, and no two experiences or perceptions are going to be exactly the same. And so when we're talking about disability, we're also talking about roadblocks to ability. And so like we were talking about before, or at least I was mentioning before, you know, trying to find a way for resiliency, that roadblock to ability is kind of where the disability is. It's not necessarily a person's inability to do things. It's just that with the proper ability, they should be able to do everything that everybody else can do. And so disability shouldn't be seen as, and that's one of the things like Susan was talking about the stigmas, is that it shouldn't be seen as something that's a can't-do attitude, but more person-centered approach, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I really appreciate that. It actually reminds me of some reading I've been doing around Gregory Bateson, and he has some work called the Ecology of Mind, which Michael White of Narrative Therapy relied on early on in the development of narrative therapy. And he talks about restraint as an important way to look at kind of how problems live in people's lives. So it's not that people have structural problems within them, but there's problems that restrain them from going in different directions. So it sounds like that what you said is quite similar. It's something that Susan, as you were talking, it reminded me of a few things that I'm aware of, somewhat of a dialogue, conversation, maybe a debate within communities of people who do have disabilities around the word disability and how it can have a negative. The word itself is the dis part. It's kind of a negative term in the sense that it's taking a stance of not fully able, and that there's some people within communities that would like to kind of come up with a new term. Have you either of you come across that or have any thoughts on that?
Yeah, and I'm really glad you brought that up because, you know, one thing I do just to kind of sensitize people to the word is, you know, whether I'm teaching or providing a training, you know, I present the word disability to try to engage people in a open and honest dialogue of what that word means to them. And a part of that is to help them be aware of what kind of images and associations do they have that they may not be aware of that are associated with that. And a part of it is to also open the discussion and help people realize that each person with a disability has their own word choice, perception of how they want to be known as or referred to. And so I think that that's really important because, you know, the word disability, you know, I'll just be candid and honest, really isn't a very good word. It's the one that we have currently, you know, and I always like to challenge students and new professionals to think of, like, what's a better word or what's a better way to handle this. I don't really have the answer on that, you know, but when we look at terms, I think no one likes to be described for any reason as different than. And the word disability does imply difference. And but on the other hand, you know, we have it for a number of reasons, partly of which I guess, you know, a part of our profession, the rehab profession, dates back, has a long history of being founded in as a part of the medical community and a need to understand and diagnose and classify. And so, you know, that's a different discussion for perhaps another day. But it's really involved. And related to that, I try to help people understand that you might come across someone who has a word choice that you really don't like. So then what do you do with that? So, for example, okay, I certainly think disability, even though it's not the best word, is kinder than some of the choices I've heard. So, for example, when working with people, I may hear someone say, well, I'm handicapped, or I'm crippled, I can't do anything. And to me, you know, those are even more outdated terms. You know, and they're a lot harsher and have even a greater amount of stigma attached to them. But they are the words that a person might use. So then the challenge is how, as a counseling professional, how do you connect with someone who this is how they describe themselves? But, you know, based on what you originally brought up, I think there's a lot of work that needs to be done to either have a better word choice or to not have the word disability. I tell students sometimes I think we should just throw out the word, but I don't know what word to have instead.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. Yeah, I was thinking about how the dis part is, it's a deficit definition. And so it kind of defines the person via some sort of deficit that they have of abilities, as opposed to maybe thinking about unique abilities that they have access to because of what they've experienced. Or, you know, I imagine, excuse me, you know, I'm thinking of maybe even someone like Temple Grandin, who is uniquely capable to do things that I would never be because of her experience. Excuse me. So I it's hard for me to consider that a disability in the sense that it's actually like the opposite of sorts, because it's really quite unique, something that I don't have access to. So it's hard to find words or a word that you could use to replace this ability that would have any kind of consensus.
And, you know, this is, you know, kind of ties into a lot of what we do in our profession, is that we, you know, Angela made reference to looking at the whole person. So in the rehab counseling profession, we look at the whole individual, and we don't describe people by their condition, but rather use person first language. You know, a person with a spinal cord mm-hmm. injury, person with a traumatic brain injury. And, you know, a part of our mission is to help people, students, professionals, individuals understand the power of language and how it can be used in a more pro-social positive way versus negative.
Yeah, I really appreciate that, the power of words.
Yeah.
Okay, so we should probably move on, because I think we could probably talk around different ideas forever. But the crux of our conversation and how I first found the both of you was a presentation you gave at the ACA conference a few years back, I guess, on the therapeutic triad, which is this interconnected, you know, kind of ball of forgiveness, self-compassion, and resilience. So I wondered if you could talk a bit about how it is that you first began, and I guess this is probably a question for Susan first, to look at the interplay between these three things and how it, how did it come up that these three things started to emerge together as something important?
Sure. Yeah, I'd be glad to. So, you know, kind of, I'll walk you through this, but kind of collectively, whenever I work with people, I always pause and smile when I think about this, because of these three, my first love was forgiveness, and then that kind of led to the other two. So it's always when I think about the therapeutic triad and the components that we've incorporated here, it just always makes my heart sing. So having said that, I first learned about forgiveness while I was a doctoral student at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. And so what was happening is I was taking, I was in my last semester of coursework, and I was taking a moral forgiveness class with Dr. Robert Enright. Otherwise, you know, we refer to him, or he's often referred to in psychology, as the father of forgiveness.
Yeah.
And so I sat there for 15 weeks, and I'm like learning about forgiveness from a new perspective. Then it really challenged me to think of it in a different way, and I was just fascinated, you know, just fascinated. I can't even explain what that process was like. And so as I was learning about it, you know, I thought, wow, you know, this is really neat, you know, and what are we doing in rehab counseling, rehab psychology? You know, we're not doing anything. And I'm like, we need to be discussing forgiveness. So from there, you know, I got really excited, because prior to that class and those 15 weeks, I kind of had an overarching interest in adaptation to disability. And so not only was I trying to look at forgiveness in relation to rehab counseling and the needs of people with disabilities, I was just constantly challenging myself to say, how does this tie into coping and adaptation to disability? So what came of that is I decided to study forgiveness as a part of my dissertation. And so with my dissertation, I explored forgiveness as one of two interventions that was administered to people with spinal cord injury. And as I was conceptualizing this, I thought, okay, I think there would be a lot of things to forgive. And I felt that because spinal cord injury is a condition that's sudden, you know, it's often traumatic, and it does change a person's life quite quickly and drastically. I thought, you know, there's probably a lot of people that think forgiveness is something that someone would do early on. But by then, I had lived with my own injury for over 20 years. And I, you know, I had racked up some experiences on a personal level that I'm going, oh, no, there's like so much more to this. You know, there's so much more. So there's just so much to consider forgiving that goes beyond the initial injury. So filtering all that, I just got very excited. And I saw forgiveness as something that people might find helpful at any time following a disability, because there's a lot of unjust and hurtful experiences people endure and are asked to cope with. And the other piece of this is I thought, you know, we're in a field where we work with people with disabilities, and we are about coping and adaptation. And we really should be doing more with this, and how come we aren't? So that really kind of gave me, you know, my start in looking at forgiveness. So then it was about 3 years later, shortly after I submitted my first book, that I found myself looking at ways to expand forgiveness. And so what that led me to was examining how does forgiveness relate to resilience. And at that time, there wasn't a lot that connected the two. So I started researching that, trying to figure out what there was. And this was in about 2011. Okay, so I was looking for a way to work with forgiveness and resilience, and how do they connect. So then from there, it led to a conference proposal. And as you brought out, you met us at last year's American Counseling Association conference. So my first look at resilience and forgiveness came in the 2012 ACA conference. And so I did a poster presentation called Forgiveness and Resiliency, and Is There a Connection to Coping with the Disability? And so still kind of trying to wrap my brain around how they might be related, you know, as life would have it, it just got even more interesting. So next thing I knew, here I am on a hotel shuttle on my way to the airport. And the van was packed. Everybody was going to the airport following the conference. And I met this gentleman, and we were talking about the conference and the potential relationship between forgiveness and resilience. And I think at that time, he may have been in northern Wisconsin for some reason. And I was telling him how I was, you know, at University of Wisconsin-Madison and studying this. And so we talked for a few minutes, and I told him how I felt this was really important for resilience when working with people with disabilities. And he agreed, and he said, you know, I think you're onto something. You should do something with this. You know, and I didn't know what to do with that. I was like, oh, okay, wow. Well, like, maybe I should, you know. So I was kind of taken back, didn't know what to do. But after I got home, I thought a lot more about that conversation. And, you know, I thought he's right. You know, there is a need for forgiveness and resilience in our work with people with disabilities. And so I got very excited about trying to connect the two. So as it would be, you know, I started to research resilience more and digging into it, looking for ways to connect the two. So that whole process led me to the development of my second book, which is called Reflections from the Past, Life Lessons for Better Living. And Reflections from the Past is a piece related to resilience and the experience of disability. And it's divided into a number of categories or domains that resemble coping strategies and skills that help people cope well with the disabilities. So, for example, there's sections on locus of control, thought and emotional regulation, coping strategies, social support, spirituality, personal growth. And I chose those domains or categories because they also tend to be areas that we know help people be resilient. And so then within each of those categories were specific resilience-based skills or lessons, and some of those included information on forgiveness. And so that was really my first, I guess, attempt at trying to connect the two. And so through some of those specific categories, I found that I could include life lessons for forgiveness. So then that whole process led to the development of a resilience intervention. So a couple years later, I co-developed a resilience intervention for people with disabilities with a colleague of mine, Dr. Michael Hartley. And in that resilience intervention, we had a module on spirituality and spiritual practices. So about half of that is entirely devoted to forgiveness. So throughout that model, we included information and exercises about learning how to forgive, how forgiveness helps alleviate personal hurt, emotional pain, and can help improve coping and adaptation. Then from there, the rest of my work began to unfold. You know, I saw how resilience and forgiveness were connected. So after doing that, I came across self-compassion kind of by accident. I often refer to it as a haphazardly process. I wasn't looking for it. I didn't know that I was even thinking that it would be needed. But what happened is I received an email one day about self-compassion and this workshop on mindful self-compassion. So reading about it, I became intrigued and decided to attend a week-long intensive training on mindfulness, on mindful self-compassion by Dr. Kristen Neff and Dr. Christopher Germer. So it was during and after that training that I started to look at self-compassion and how it might be applicable to the needs and experiences of people with disabilities. So as you can probably see where this conversation is going, when I get excited about something, you know, that's game over. I just have to learn everything I can about it. And a lot of how I process information is that application piece. Not only what am I learning, but what can I do with that? How does that apply to our profession and to working with people with disabilities? So I became convinced that self-compassion and self-compassion cultivation could be of therapeutic value to the people we serve. So I tried to learn as much as I could about self-compassion, all the while asking myself, how does this relate to people with disabilities? How can it help them cope? And then through that process, I similar to forgiveness, I started to ask myself, how does self-compassion relate to helping people be more resilient? So when Dr. Hartley and I were putting together the resilience intervention, we also included a module on compassion and self-compassion. And then it was a couple years after that, in 2014, 2015, Angela and I started to conduct research on the intervention among people with disabilities. So we did two pilot studies on the resilience intervention and found it helped to reduce depression and anxiety, as well as increase forgiveness and resilience. And as a part of these studies, people continued to share their thoughts and experiences with forgiveness and self-compassion. And for a lot of people, it was a very new, both forgiveness and self-compassion were approaches they hadn't thought a lot about, especially the self-compassion piece seemed to be very new and hadn't previously been a part of their coping repertoire. So from this, these experiences and people's feedback with the research, it cemented my thinking and convinced me that each of these, forgiveness, self-compassion, and resilience, are vital and important for people to learn about and access as a part of the resilience process. So from there, it just kind of continued. And so today, as Angela and I talk about the therapeutic triad, it's really hard to think of one and not immediately think of the other two. So it's, I guess, kind of been, for me, it's been kind of like a dance in that each one has their purpose, but in the end, it just has its rhythm and comes together.
Yeah, it reminds me of kind of this stool analogy of three legs keep the stool upright, and if you take one away, the whole thing, well, I guess the whole thing doesn't fall apart. That's probably not an adequate way to describe it, but that the each piece of this triad is vital. And I love that it kind of got some steam on a shuttle bus to the airport. That just adds to the excitement of the story. Angela, I know that you also came to this through forgiveness primarily, but then also through some of your work with post-traumatic stress. Could you talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, so for me, the triad, the therapeutic triad that we're talking about with resiliency, compassion, forgiveness, it started out more actually not with forgiveness, but more with resiliency. I had grown up in a military family, you know, both sides of my family, both the paternal and the maternal, being heavily in the military. And so watching even my brothers go to war and come back, you know, was pretty, you know, hard for me to watch. And yeah. So watching them switch from military life back to civilian life is what got me started really thinking about resiliency and how do you help people that have been through some serious trauma? How do you help them grasp their lives back? Because oftentimes, you know, you can get wrapped up in that trauma. And so that's kind of where I first started. And so that was mostly in grad school. And I was really pushing resiliency and finding out that there wasn't a lot of research out there pertaining to resiliency. And a lot of the research that was out there was predominantly coming back from the Boston VA Medical Center was where I was seeing a lot of it coming out of. Utilizing resiliency before and after in troops to see if they can instill it. And so that's kind of where I was going mostly with my graduate studies. And then, of course, you know, Susan and I met up and she introduced me to Enright and Fitzgibbon's books on forgiveness. And then I had a whole new light on what forgiveness really was. Because, you know, we're always taught that we can forgive others. But then when I realized you could forgive yourself, it was like, I mean, like, you know, it's out there, like you could forgive yourself, but it was like this light bulb clicked that like you could actually forgive yourself and you could do it without guilt and this stuff where you feel like you have to pay all this penance and, you know, and so or waiting for people to say sorry or so on and so forth. And so that's where the forgiveness piece really started to take light with me. And I realized that with that partnered with self-compassion was a level of empowerment that you can hand to somebody that I don't think any other, you know, way of going about it can. That's where I was at. And so my original work, like I said, was helping with post-traumatic stress and traumatic brain injury, did my three. And so that triadic approach was so much more growing and empowering for myself that I really wanted to, like, pass that passion on to others. And so that's where I started to really develop my sense of what this three could actually do for people's lives. And then, of course, I get to see it on a regular basis because I get to run these interventions. And so I get to see it changing people's lives on a daily basis. And I got to tell you, that's empowering, too.
Yeah, yeah. As you were talking about watching your brothers go away to war and coming back, I don't. Well, my father-in-law was a career military man, but I didn't have a lot of direct connection to the military until I got married. And but I just finished Ken Burns and I forgot Lynn Novick's 10-part series on the Vietnam War. And they, mm-hmm. there's these amazing interviews with the men and women who served in the war. And I hadn't really thought about it until you were talking about when I reflected. And because it was really profound hearing them speak and kind of mm-hmm. thinking, wow, if I can ever become that kind of person, I will be happy with myself. But I'm not there. But their voices and their words and their comments were full of forgiveness and self-compassion and resilience. And I hadn't really thought about that until you kind of drew those two things together, and it seems so profound now that I think about it that if it wasn't a 20 hour series, I'd go back and watch it with that in mind. But I appreciate you drawing those connections.
Yeah.
Okay, so this may be a bit obvious, and I think that kind of all of these three things, forgiveness, self-compassion, resilience, at least in modern times, kind of come with a definition built in. We tend to think we know what we mean when we say these things, but I know within your work, there's probably more specific meanings and ways in which these ideas are misconstrued in popular media and self-help books and whatnot. So I wonder if we could spend some time unpacking what each of these terms mean and some of the benefits of each of these, and then what are some of the barriers our clients face when trying to cultivate each of these pieces of the triad?
Sure. So when we talk about these terms, it's important to note that while we have an understanding of what is forgiveness, self-compassion, or resilience, that each person may have their own idea of what each means. And so I think it's really important as we go through the counseling process to check with the individual and to also encourage them to consider their own view of forgiveness, self-compassion, and resilience, and to determine what each of those would look like in their own life should they be achieved. And I think that's important because the more people own something, or the more personal it is, then I think it has meaning and value to them. Yeah. So, as indicated earlier, I came across forgiveness while I was a doctoral student at the University of Wisconsin, and I was taking the moral forgiveness class from Dr. Enright. And so a lot of our understanding comes from that definition and much of his work. So forgiveness is referred to as the release of negative thoughts, emotions, and behaviors, and the increase of positive or neutral ones. As Angela said, forgiveness can include the need to forgive yourself, others, or God. And I think that's really important when we factor in the experience of living with a disability. And I say that because the experience of disability can often challenge what a person believes as right or wrong. What does it mean to them personally, religiously, spiritually? And so sometimes there is that part about God or a higher power that comes up. Forgiveness is a personal choice that a person makes, and something a person does, even if the other person or offending party doesn't deserve it. And I think it's also important for people to know that forgiveness is not a quick fix and something that occurs over time. So for many, it's not easy to forgive, which complicates the process. And so while we look at all these pieces that are a part of forgiveness, two that stand out to me when working with people with disabilities, as I mentioned, are the need to forgive oneself, others, or God, and the fact that forgiveness is really difficult for many people, and it can be quite lengthy. And I know we'll talk a little bit and a little bit about some of the barriers, but sometimes people get into this process of what it of forgiveness and what they're going to do in their life to go forward with it. But although it's very healing, it can be a very messy process for some people. And so it does unpack and uncover some of the feelings and thoughts that people have. And so learning to not live life in the same way and to work with the hurt that they experience and to find compassion and healing in that can be really hard. So then when we talk about self-compassion, we draw upon the definition given by Dr. Kristen Neff, associate professor at University of Texas, Austin, Department of Educational Psychology. So she refers to compassion as a person's ability to be kind, tolerant, loving, accepting, and forgiving towards a person when they're hurt or in the midst of their emotional pain. Self-compassion and the practice of self-compassion gives people an opportunity to be kind to themselves instead of self-critical and judgmental when they're having some sort of difficulty or experiencing something that didn't turn out to their liking. Self-compassion gives people permission to accept themselves as they are, imperfections and all, so they may face their difficulties in an emotionally balanced way. And you know, that part about being kind, tolerant, loving, and forgiving is really hard for some people. In Angela's, my work, we have found that to be true kind of over and over and over. So a lot of what we've tried to stress is to encourage people to consider the relationship they have with themselves, you know, and to really ask them, how kind, loving, forgiving are you of yourself versus critical or judgmental? So, you know, that whole process opens up more possibilities for people. Then resilience, similar to forgiveness, is a term that's not always uniformly defined. So oftentimes scholars will refer to resilience as the ability to bend or bounce back following a traumatic or difficult life event. And understanding that's important because what this tells us is that for resilience to occur, people must experience a traumatic or life-changing event through which there's some sort of adversity. And through this event, people learn that the skills and abilities they have may not be enough, and so they need to do something different. So one thing I often do with people when I provide trainings is, you know, I'm always thankful that there's somebody who raises their hands and it's not just me. But, you know, I will ask groups of people, without getting too personal, to, you know, think of their life and experiences in their life and to at least raise their hand if they've ever had the experience where you think, yeah, you know, I'm a really good coper. I can deal with like anything. And then bam, you go through something totally unexpected, or maybe it was expected, and you're kind of standing there, and then all the skills and coping abilities you had just like aren't working. Like I said earlier, thankfully there's always some people that raise their hand, you know. And I think these are very powerful and defining moments in people's lives because they help us understand that we might cope well most of the time, but right now we're faced with something different, something that is going to require us to change and possibly develop more skills. And that's a key feature of what we try to stress with resilience. So, you know, these are some of the commonalities that a lot of people have given as they define resilience. But again, as I've mentioned before, a lot of the work that's been done hasn't been directly tied to or connected with people with disabilities or the experience of disability. So Dr. Hartley, who's an associate professor in the Counseling and Mental Health Program at University of Arizona, he and I define resilience a little differently. And a lot of it has to do because of our understanding and experience with people with disabilities. So we define, first I'll define it for you, and then I'll kind of break out the main points that we're trying to stress. So we define resilience as an individual's ability to deal, or okay, it as resilience as an individual's ability to learn and enhance personal skills and characteristics following the presence of a disability, which can be used and refined to help them cope with their situation and disability-related experiences, improve personal insight and knowledge of their skills and potential to overcome challenging life events, and to live in a way that reflects a better quality of life. As a result of their decisions, actions, and behavior, persons with disabilities are able to learn skills that help them experience fewer negative thoughts and feelings, recognize and acknowledge positive ones, and make decisions that help them live life, live the life they seek. So from this definition, there's six main points that we aim to stress. One is that resilience skills can be learned. A person's ability to cope is not contingent on how they're currently functioning. And I think that's really an important point, because when people realize that they are not bound to exist or be based on their present moment, but that they can do something about it, it is the beginning of giving them hope that I can do something to help myself. Second point that we try to stress is that people may have useful coping skills, but that they have not been using them or that they have stopped working. So there's room to enhance them. So back to when I gave you the example of asking for volunteers to share if they ever had that life awakening moment where they've gone through something and the skills they have aren't working. It's the same with resilience. And so then people realize that sometimes through this process, they realize they have a lot of good skills. But then Angela and I have often asked them, well, when's the last time you used them? And so, you know,
yeah, that's a great question.
Memories, yeah, memories that I have of this is people would say, well, you know, in a humorous way, you know, and in a safe environment, they would say, well, you know, Susan, it's been a while. You know, I haven't used those skills. And I say, okay, well, that's great. Now you know that. So let's think about if we want to, if they still apply, and if you want to take them out of the closet, dust them off and do something with them. So sometimes people do realize through this resilience process they have skills, but they just forgot that they had them. So then a third point we try to stress is how resilience can be applied to multiple parts of people's lives. We give them a choice in picking one part of their life they want to work on, because we find it helps give people focus. Without it, they sometimes become really overwhelmed. But then as we come full circle, then they realize there's what we call the carryover effect, that when they work on resilience in one part of their life, the carryover effect is that it naturally improves other parts, because they start working on resilience in more than one part of their life. So then the fourth thing we try to stress is that through inward examination and a willingness to help oneself, people increase their chances of learning about themselves. So resilience isn't a process where you get to sit there and hope that things improve, but it is rather an action and intentional process where you're doing something to make things better. Number five, people who apply resilience-based skills may discover they have the ability to deal with challenges better than they thought. And it's through this process that they increase their coping ability and their quality of life. So again, people may realize, you know, yeah, I think I can do that. And so one of my favorite stories that I just would like to interject is when Angela and I were doing some of this work together, you know, we would have people work on different skills each week, come back, talk to us about what they learned. And so one story that has always stood out in my mind was an older woman who really didn't like computers, and asking for help was also really very hard. And so she came back one week and shared with us about how delighted she was because her computer, I don't know if it blew up or froze, but something happened. And normally this would be very frustrated, but because she was working with us and learning about resilience, she decided to make a different choice. Okay. So she comes back and tells us how she went to Best Buy, actually flagged down an employee and told them about her problem and asked for help, and everything got fixed, and she was so delighted. And you know, it was a moment to rejoice, because this is something that, well, to some people it might not sound like a big deal, but to her this was very hard. And so the idea with resilience is that when people start having successes, no matter how large or how small, when they start seeing those changes in their life, then it gives them motivation to keep going and taking more risks and trying new things. And so they come to believe that they can make a difference. So that story actually ties to the last point that we try to stress, which is as people apply resilience skills, they have fewer negative thoughts and feelings, more positive ones, and they become more engaged in their decision-making process. And then as a result, they believe that change is possible and they're more motivated to try. And as we know, when people are more motivated to try, then they start seeing, yeah, I got this, I can do this. And so this whole notion of resilience does build in a lot of hope for people.
Yeah, thank you. That's extremely thorough. And I appreciate the nuance that you offer in defining these things, because I know that there's, you know, there's Enright and there's Everett Worthington who might have a different take on forgiveness, and there's going to be different definitions of compassion and resilience in it. It's important to kind of build these things out in meaningful ways. So I appreciate you and those you work with taking the time to really build out this idea of resilience more specifically, and especially as it relates to the communities that you work with. Well, Susan and Angela, thank you so much for taking the time. I guess this brings us to the end of our first part in this conversation, and we'll pick up where we left off in the conversation next week. So thank you both for taking the time.
You are very welcome. Glad to do it.
Yes, thank you, Mike.
Hey, folks, thanks for listening to this episode of The Thoughtful Counselor. If you haven't already, please head over to iTunes and subscribe to the podcast. Or if you've already subscribed, why not head over there and leave a rating and a review? And if you've done both of those things already, why not share the podcast with a friend? And if you've already done all three of those things, well, you're just plain awesome. Thanks again for listening, and stay tuned for next week.